Case number 16-12-1028 et al. Browning Ferris Industries of California, Inc., doing business as BFI Nubai Island Recycling Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Deidelberg for the petitioner, Mr. Heller for the respondent, Mr. Becker for the intervener.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Joshua Deidelberg, appearing for Browning Ferris. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time. The board says that its due joint employment test follows the common law and Taft-Hartley, but it does not. And I'd like to address three key areas where the board's common law approach is flawed. As a threshold matter, whereas here the board is arguing for a new common law formulation, its test is not entitled to the deference of this court on that issue. Its test has to comport with the consensus of the judicially crafted common law and Congress's intent. So first, the board's new test, as the dissent pointed out.
Can I ask one question for clarification?
Yes.
Does that mean the state of the common law at the time of the Taft-Hartley Act, or does it continue to evolve?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, Congress had a definite vision of the common law when it passed Taft-Hartley 70 years ago. In fact, in the legislative history that we've cited, it took issue with the board essentially floating new meanings that didn't exist.
No, I get that. That was because they thought it was divorced from common law analysis. But my question is more narrow than that, and that is, do we mean we freeze common law in time at the year of the Taft-Hartley Act, or when Congress said, no, common law is going to control here, this isn't something that you have expertise in, we just need common law definition, and that common law definition isn't frozen in time?
Well, I believe it is frozen in time, and indeed even the board is not looking to apply the restatement third of agency or the restatement of employment law. Their test is premised on the restatement second of agency. They take a historical approach.
Is that how it works under all the other statutes that look to common law of agency for definition of an employee, employment, those types of things? Has any court ever held that it's frozen in time?
Well, you have a unique history here because you have a situation where in Taft-Hartley, the Congress took the unusual approach of excoriating the board.
No, but it didn't say anything there about the common law can't move after this year.
Well, again, I would point to that legislative history and the notion that they were very concerned with the board having a floating definition.
I get that, but that's a different problem, right? They weren't concerned with the common law evolving. They were concerned with the board having departed from the common law and put policy factors in as part of its decision-making, right?
Well, I do think that they were concerned about overturning a particular concept of the common law, or lack of common law that the Supreme Court had.
So you have language that's set in the statute that says common law is frozen?
There's no explicit language in that regard.
The Taft-Hartley amendments, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Were in 1947, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't the restatement second of agency approved in 1958?
Yeah, it was actually the restatement first was in effect then, but there's really no difference in the text between the two restatements.
So really we have to go back to the restatement first. We can't even look at the restatement second.
Well, there's no substantive difference.
Just to be safe, though.
Yeah. Yes. But certainly not the restatement of employment law, which is not a restatement of the common law, but essentially an attempt to...
Well, it's a restatement of state common law. It absolutely is. It says in the restatement of employment law itself, we're restating state common law of employment.
Well, but it's also stretching across a variety of federal statutes, for example, that have different histories and different purposes. you know,
yes,
such as...
Yes, but it says we're restating that we, in fact, eschew trying to restate statutory law. We are restating common law. That's what it says.
Okay. The first area where the board's test is problematic is that, as the dissent pointed out, it's possible to have a joint employer finding without the need for a pervasive amount of direct and immediate control over the employment details of particular workers. And the center of gravity in the common law and in this court's approach, and I believe reflecting the intent of Congress, is active control. The actual case, the Third Circuit Browning-Ferris case, which the board says that it's relying upon and wants to get back to, the actual holding of that case is that the putative joint employer exerted control. And the findings were that the putative employer exerted control. I believe it's at 1124. That's the actual holding of the case. And, you know, that notion of exertion of control dovetails, again, with Congress's understanding of the essence of a common law employment relationship as direct supervision of the meta inquiry of this court.
Well, on page 1120 of Browning-Ferris, we talk about BFI notes that the hours of operation at the transfer site were set by the city, can only be changed by the city. And what the Third Circuit said is BFI continues to have the authority to set the shifts. So doesn't that mean that they were following the text of the restatement second and looking at both authority that's unexercised and actual exercise authority? That's what it says they're doing right there.
I believe when the court describes its holding, it describes it in terms of the fact that Browning-Ferris was exerting control.
Well, it can't possibly, because part of the evidence, it can't be exclusively that.
It's not exclusively
that. Okay, so it was looking at both things.
You know, as I said, it's looking at both things, but the center of gravity is active control. I mean, I think when the court described its control jurisprudence, for example, in FedEx 1, it noted that, you know, the most significant factor, the most important factor, is active control.
Right. So what do you mean by center of gravity or most important factor? Does that mean that you're not disputing that they can, when they put all the factors out on the table and all the evidence on the table, they can include consideration of authority that they have but isn't exercised? Do you dispute that they can include consideration of that?
Well, you know, basically, you know, the board is not arguing for a mechanical application, for example, of the 220 factors. Basically, what it has is three buckets: direct control, indirect control, and potential control, or right to control. We would argue, and I would speak to this, that the indirect control bucket hasn't even been found to be a factor. I mean, there's no judicial consensus at all in terms
of... Can we just focus for now?
Yes.
We'll take these one piece at
sure.
a time. Let's just focus on the reserved authority, or has
right.
the authority, unexercised authority.
Right.
So which you got two buckets.
Right.
Direct authority, which I assume
right.
when you say direct, you mean direct
I mean
exercised
direct,
authority.
Active, immediate, proximate.
Right. And the authority to right. exercise, unexercised authority.
Yes.
As to those, I just have a narrow question, because
right.
I noticed you were saying center of gravity. So I take it
sure.
you agree that they can consider, when they lay everything out, they can certainly consider as a relevant factor unexercised authority as they did in Browning-Ferris.
They can consider it, but the focus of this court, for example, you know, is to discount the right of control or to give it no weight in relation to the party's actual practice.
I wonder, as far as the potential, the right to control,
yes.
Are there any other, I see three areas where that was true with respect to the employment relationship here. One was the contract provided that an employee of the
Lead Point, Your Honor.
Lead Point. That could only work 6 months.
Yes.
And Browning never enforced that.
That's right.
Two, that it could refuse to allow any particular employee of Lead Point to work on the premises. But it never exercised that.
Correct.
And third, it capped the wages so that the wages of Lead Point employees were not higher than the FIs.
And that was ultimately illusory, Your Honor. Yes, it was never enforced.
Is there any other area where there was potential right to control but not exercised?
Well, I think there was a discussion of sort of setting pre-performance qualifications, for example, for the contractor's agents.
Discussion of? Was that part of the contract?
It was part of the contract, but it was also never enforced.
Never enforced. On the six-month business, I guess it's a right to control, but it seems to me that that reflects more in favor of your position than not. It shows an intention on the parties that we're not going to have a bunch of permanent employees here on the premises. So whether you enforced it or not, I mean, it seems to me a point in favor of your position.
Well, that's right. I mean, ultimately, the court's control jurisprudence has been getting to what is the actual relationship to the parties? What is their actual practice? What's actually going on here? You know, in contracts, there's often, as you know, a lot of protective language, a lot of rainy day, worst case scenario language that never gets enforced, that's never intended to be enforced except in the most extreme circumstances.
Can I clarify what you mean by not enforced in the sense of, was it not enforced in that the record shows that, in fact, people stayed more than 6 months, salaries went higher, people were getting paid more than the one Browning Ferris employee that was on the line, or not enforced in that Lead Point just, you know, colored within the lines, and so it never became an issue in that Browning Ferris never had to say, bad, don't do that? Which is it?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, it's really, you know, more the first in the sense that, you know, I mean, it was never an issue between the parties. It never...
Did they pay a wage to, did Lead Point pay a wage to its employees that was higher than the one Browning Ferris employee?
It did not, but the record said that they never sought to do so.
Well, but why would you seek to do so when the contract says you? I'm just trying to figure out because whether that counts as an exercise or it's having exactly the effect it's meant to. Why, if I have a contract that says I can't do something, why would I try to do it?
Well, in this
and that
particular
means that
case,
contract comes
I mean,
having
it
no
was
effect?
Really illusory. It was never going to be a consideration. First,
what does
know,
that mean? They just were never going to pay the people that much.
Yeah, I mean, in the facts of this case, $5 an hour was much higher than, you know, any of what the Lead Point employees were getting. It was just never an economic consideration for the contractor.
I wanted to follow up on the right to control thing.
Sure.
So I named three. You add one pre-approval training or qualification.
Yes.
But it seems to me there's another. And again, not necessarily against your position, and that is that, as I understand it, this contract was terminable at will.
Yes.
But they never terminated. Isn't that a right to control? I mean, that's saying that every employee of Lead Point will lose his job.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's terminable at will seems to me to cut in your favor.
Well, potentially so.
As far as the relationship is concerned.
Yes, and it's also, you know, one of the problems with the board's indirect and reserve control approach, which is it's basically conflating economic dependence and economic influence in a business relationship with control over the employees themselves.
But were they going to lose their job, or were they just going to not work on the Lead Point or on the Browning Ferris contract?
They were not going to work on the Browning Ferris contract. In fact, you know, there's nothing in the contract that says that they have to lose employment with Lead Point generally.
Right.
So just so that I'm clear, what are you arguing is our standard of review of the test itself? Are you saying it's de novo?
It's de novo, Your Honor, because it's a pure law question under the common law. The board is arguing for a new formulation.
What do you do with the cases talking about fairly conflicting views?
I mean, as the court,
how do you read those?
Right, as the court held last week, that really more goes to the application of law to facts, and not when the board is arguing for a new formulation.
And what about the Corporate Express case, where the board, this was an independent contractor case, yes. And the board had traditionally, was applying the common law factors and said, you know, the main thing is control. Mm-hmm. But then in Corporate Express, they said, we're actually going to change the emphasis here, and we're going to look at entrepreneurial opportunity. So we'll march through the factors, but we're really changing what it is we're looking for under the common law. And this court said that decision by the board was reasonable.
I mean, I think that's a de facto change in their standard. I mean, they have overturned 30 years of precedent.
I'm sorry, are you talking about Corporate Express or this case?
This case, Your Honor.
No, I just want to know, on standard of review, what do we do about the fact that when you have the board continuing to apply the common law factors and saying, right, I'm going to apply the common law, but I'm going to emphasize these particular factors, and we didn't say de novo, we said it was upheld it because it was, quote, reasonable, which sounds like a Chevron review. What do we do with that case on deciding?
Right.
I get you that it's not crystal clear in our precedent, but yeah, I'm not sure what to do with that case.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, the touchstone, you know, is the common law, and ultimately, you know, this court as a common law court, you know, is going to have to determine whether, you know, the test or the application of the formulation is ultimately consistent with the common law. And the issue in this case is that ultimately what the board is doing is not. There's no judicial consensus for its indirect control theory. They cite a single 1962 Fourth Circuit case, which is actually a single employer case. This court has never held that indirect control, as they conceive of it, is even a factor under the analysis.
One of the problems of using the restatement of agency, and so I guess the main provision is 226, right? Is that right?
220, 227, 5.
Is that really mainly dealing with liability and tort cases as opposed to the employment relationship that we have here? And so I, you know, who knows what the common law is on joint employers. There's not much. There's one little, a sub J in 227 that mentions it, but
I mean, there's really almost nothing. I mean, you know, the restatement obviously was not codified into the act. And if it were, you know, sort of the end of the analysis, then we probably wouldn't be here because there's no real discussion of joint employer relationships as such under the restatement.
But there are considerations for holding one company liable when you have two companies involved.
Yes.
In a tort case are rather different than the considerations in the labor relations field. I mean, you're talking about deep pockets and you're trying, you know, employers may try to evade financial responsibility for unsafe working conditions and all the rest of those things, which is not really directly on point with the employment relationships.
Yes. No, I agree. I mean, if one were to look at the restatement, I mean, there is, as I'm sure you saw, an example that's based on the Greyhound case. And I think it's notable that the comments there focus on the active control, the active supervision of the customer, of the client.
Well, are you saying that we shouldn't be looking at the restatement of agency? We should be looking at the restatement of employment law, which your amicus, the Chamber of Commerce, says we should do for the reasons Judge Randolph articulated. The agency law just doesn't fit this situation. Is that your position?
It's not our position, but, you know, since...
So notwithstanding the odd fit for tort liability and defining joint employer, you're saying we need to look at, you disagree with the Chamber of Commerce and say we need to look to the restatement of agency law.
I mean, I think ultimately one is looking at control factors. That is, you know, the focus. And we've argued that there needs to be a historical application. I'm simply arguing the alternative, if the court is so inclined, you know, for whatever reason, to look at the restatement of employment. I think the Greyhound example favors our position.
Can I ask, what does, I guess I have two questions. One is, you keep going to the indirect control when you say there's no judicial authority for that, but
yes.
I take it you're recognizing that there's both repeated text in the restatement of agency and case law that addresses reserve control, unexercised control as a factor. And it was in Browning Ferris itself from the Third Circuit.
Yes, there is.
So that doesn't have, you think that's, in a, well, as indirect control right. has some arguments that as to reserved authority.
I would break down the three buckets mm-hmm. this way very simply. The focus of the analysis is ultimately on the party's actual practice and not this kind of protective language. So that's why I say that the center of gravity, and in this court's control jurisprudence has been on active control. Mm-hmm. Reserve control has been recognized as a factor, but if you look at cases such as Local 777 or Herbert Harvey, where the court has weighed active versus reserve control, its turn has always been to the party's actual practice. It wants to know how in reality, how in practice, have the parties ordered their relationship. What are they really doing vis-a-vis each other? And with respect to indirect control, there's no judicial consensus for that. In fact, in Aurora Packing,
just to stay back on the reserve control issue. If you had, let's just pretend there's no indirect control bucket for purposes of answering this. I get that you've got arguments about that.
Sure.
As to the reserved control, because before you said, yeah, they can consider it, but it can't have any legal determinative force, which there's not much point in considering something. If you sort of had a situation where the facts were 50-50, some of these things look like direct control, but some of these things do not, could reserve control make the difference?
I don't believe so. I think ultimately...
So it can't have... What's the point of considering something that can have no legal impact?
It's part of, the mise-en-scene.
It's not the part of it. Can't count for anything. You can talk about it, I guess, because you have a right to say whatever you want to say, but it has no legal impact, so why consider it? It can't make a difference.
It's a factor, it's not a heavily weighted factor.
In what area of law do we have a factor that can't make a difference and have no impact at all?
I go back to, the underscoring of active control is at the center.
Underscoring just may mean that gets counted twice or something, but it doesn't mean that the one doesn't get counted at all and couldn't make a difference.
Right. I just have to point out this court's cases.
And there's got to be a timing question here, too, to just follow up. If the contract has only been in existence, when the unfair labor practice charges get filed and go through the board, if the contract has only been in existence for a month, then it may be that everything you're talking about is potential to control, because there hasn't been a long history of exercising the contract and the terms and conditions of the particular joint agreement.
Yes.
So, I think there's got to be a timing factor built into this, too.
Well, potentially so. Where you have months and years of experience, where you can look at a pattern of pervasive control or the lack of it, then I think that's what you look to.
We talk about the common law of joint employers, but there's also a common law of the factory or the particular plant that grows up after a period of time where things are done in a certain way, even though they're not particularly spelled out. Right. But that takes some time to develop, and grievance procedures and resolving things and so on and so forth.
Right. Contracts are entry points. You need to see over in the fullness of time how they're actually enforced or not enforced.
So does that mean if the representation petition is filed in the first 2 months of a contract like this, you could have one answer, and if it's filed after 2 years, you could have a different answer? Exact same contract?
Well, I think it may be unfortunate timing for the union.
But it could be different.
I'm sorry?
It could be different based on that timing?
Well, you're going to have more evidence, obviously, of active control or lack of active control mm-hmm. over a longer period of time.
So if you don't have that evidence, then reserved authority counts for more. If we don't have a lot of time yet.
Would it count for more?
Because we don't really know who's going to be as Judge Randolph said.
Yes,
agreed, I thought.
In that hypothetical, which is not this case, where you don't have, a body of active control, I think more so. But I think
trying to test the board's...
I understand.
Test, they have a decision here that you're challenging, a rule of law that you're challenging, and you are challenging buckets. And one of those buckets was reserved authority. And so I'm just trying to clarify, in response to Judge Randolph, makes a very fair point that it's a factual matter. Everything's reserved the first week, right?
Yes.
And so is this, the difficulty with that is it sounds like when they, how fast they file this petition is going to get a different answer.
I'm not sure what to do with it. Yes.
It's commonsensical as it is.
I would say in that circumstance, there's simply no sufficient quantum of active control that's been exercised. We don't know what the relationship between the parties actually is in practice, and in the absence of that evidence of active control, we can't find a joint employment relationship.
Now, you'd wanted to talk about indirect control, and I just have a question.
Sure.
What does indirect control mean? Do you understand what, not in your own opinion, from the board's decision, I tell my clerk to tell you something, is that indirect control, or?
I think it actually means a few things in the way that they express in their opinion. Let me see if I can break those down. So, where the board is talking about control that is essentially based on the putative employer's or the customer's ability to potentially control or change its operations, that is one aspect of indirect control that they've identified. And in Aurora Packing...
But would that be different from the reserved authority? I'm just trying to really understand. That sounds like that overlaps with reserved authority.
Well, that's talking more, for example, with respect to, the work streams. Browning Ferris has a certain business. They are open certain hours of the day for various, business and entrepreneurial reasons. And, that's the essence of their operation. In Aurora Packing, this court held that those kinds of considerations aren't even control at all. If you're going to force the customer to, reconstitute its business or fundamentally change its business, that can't be control. So that's one aspect of the indirect control bucket. Mm-hmm. The second is where the board impermissibly conflates economic influence over the contractor with control over the contractor's employees. And it shows up in places like where the board stresses the at-will nature of the contract. Essentially, it's an economic dependence or influence message that if you don't do what we say, we're going to cancel our contract. It's not control over the employees. It's economic influence being exercised as against the contractor itself, or in other areas where the customer, Browning Ferris, is making requests or is stating preferences, where the board claims that a certain outcome is preordained. But remember that the premise of a joint employer relationship is that you have two independent businesses that are each capable of exercising their own discretion. And so where a test in its application is essentially saying that, you're going to, knuckle under for economic influence or economic dependence reasons. That could be potentially a factor in some other statute, but under the economic realities analysis that the board is forbidden to apply under the NLRA, it's improper. That's why the EEOC's brief was so mystifying and telling to say that they're the same test, because they can't be the same test. There is this separate history under the NLRA that does not exist under Title VII, the FLSA, and so forth, where Congress did
not. Do you mean by that it's a different common law definition of employee employment under Title VII than it is under the NLRA? Because they both say they look to the common law.
Well, they both look to the common law, but one of the issues with, sort of the development of the test, and even this court sort of has two parallel tests, is that the FLSA test, the Title VII test, has been infused with...
Well, Title VII doesn't have the same definition as the FLSA, so we can take that off the table.
Okay.
So Title VII looks to the common law. NLRA looks to the common law. That's what the meaning of the Taft-Hartley was, look to the common law. So is your position that common law of joint employer could mean one thing for Title VII and something different for the NLRA? Or does it have to be the same? Which of those, different or same?
With respect to the pure common law, presumably the same. But, again, in Title VII jurisprudence and FLSA jurisprudence, there's this whole overlay of business reality or economic.
Where's that in a Title VII case?
Where in a Title VII case?
What Title VII case said we don't, when we said, we mean common law with a wink.
Common law with a, well, I mean, it, you know, it's looking to ultimate purposes. It's looking to
what
economic
case
realities.
Says, what case says, well, you can go start with the common law, but feel free under Title VII to overlay economic realities?
You know, if overlay is the wrong term, you know, in Al-Safi, for example, there's a discussion of, you know, one test, which is sort of the pure Browning-Ferris common law test, and then the other test, I think Spirides was the case, in which it's sort of common law plus consideration of economic realities.
And Al-Safi said, we don't need to resolve that here. We're going with the Browning-Ferris common law. And it wasn't even a close issue there. It wasn't going to make a difference which test was applied. But that's not, we didn't hold there that for purposes of Title VII, when it says common law, that that's a common law plus meaning. I thought the Supreme Court been pretty clear it's common law
it is
for Title VII. So it has to be this, I mean, whatever meaning of joint employer there is under the NLRA, it's going to have to govern Title VII, Americans with Disabilities Act, FELA, not FLSA, that's maybe not.
Yes.
That's a little different. But as to all those, we're going to have one rule here.
You know, it, you know, except as we've argued that there's a historical grounding, you know. With,
no, the historical grounding just said go look at the common law. Like, I don't see how that historical grounding said it's going to be different common law, because we can't do the frozen in time. Then we can't, if it is, if we do frozen in time, we can't even look at the restatement second. So it can't be a different common law. That's a pure question of law, and it's going to have one meaning on Monday and right, the same meaning on Tuesday in a Title VII case, right?
You know, but in this particular legislative history, you know, Congress is saying, you know, again, don't tell us what, you know, the meanings, you know, give us the meanings at the time the Wagner Act was enacted. Mm-hmm. You know, don't change the meanings.
So we, you know, can't look at Restatement Second, even though that's what you briefed us.
We, you know, we took their control arguments head on. There's no real substantive difference between the first and the second restatement.
This is a common feature of historical analysis. The history doesn't change, but the interpretation of the history can evolve over time, even though the events are in the past and over, and nobody questions it. And so, you know, one way of looking at this is that the cases, particularly in this circuit and the Supreme Court case, and particularly Kelly, I think, which you highlight, is an evolving understanding of what the common law was at the time that the Taft-Hartley was in there.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this. I mean, in Taft-Hartley, Congress took, again, the unusual act of seeking to overcome a Supreme Court decision.
That's and not in, unusual.
Maybe more common these days, but.
I don't know if these days.
Eskridge, right. Professor Eskridge has an article in the Georgetown Law Journal years back of hundreds of cases where Congress has done that.
But we have in Hearst a case study of what Congress did not want to constitute an employment relationship. And that included, you know, findings of broad contours of work, control over broad contours as opposed to the minutiae of daily activities, which was significant. You know, I think mm-hmm. circling back to your original question, Your Honor, mm-hmm. in terms of the indirect control bucket, mm-hmm. you know, so we have, the Aurora packing aspect of it, which, you know, this court has said is not even control when you're talking about having to fundamentally change relationships.
I thought you said there were three things. Am I wrong that they've done that are indirect control?
Well,
you've only given us
yes.
two.
I was talking about the buckets. I mean,
right.
Skipping ahead, the third is that in not giving effect to the limited and routine control aspects of control, the board is not recognizing that there are certain aspects of control, even direct control, which this court and other courts have found are not probative with respect, you know, and in fact are fully consistent with contractor relationships. Mm-hmm. And they're in a range of this court's cases, like mm-hmm. North American Van Lines mm-hmm. And so forth, talking about, you know, monitoring or evaluating worker performance mm-hmm. or ends, mm-hmm. customer demand. Mm-hmm. Satisfying statutory obligations and the like.
What do you think that language meant? That's hard for me to, you know, there's double negative in the sentence, and what exactly do you think that they meant there with that particular sentence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let me see if I can find exactly how they said it. But they're... of course, I can't find it because I want to now.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, what is it that you think that they meant by this? It has to not be more than, they were no longer say that it has to not be more than limited and routine. I think that's the way that they
well,
I mean, what do you think that we were really,
yes.
Yeah, we will no longer require that a joint employer exercise authority not in a limited and routine manner.
I think it's on page 14.
Right.
Or JA 382. Neither does it require that control, when it is exercised, must be exercised directly and immediately and not in a limited and routine manner. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yes. There are various forms of control, even forms of direct control, which this court and this courts have found are nonetheless consistent with a contractor relationship. In those principles that I was referring to that are in a number of the court's cases, such as North American Van Lines, and we've referenced them in our brief. Specifically with respect to limited routine control, what the board has often described that as is, you know, the what, where, and when of performance. And remember, these are ultimately customer relationships, and if a customer can't, you know, control the basic what, where, and when of the performance it seeks, it's hard to see where there could be any contractor relationships yet left. And if you combine that with what I think is one of the key sentences in the board's analysis on 382, where it talks about, where it is honing in on its vision of joint employment, you know, and says where one party owns and controls the premises, where it controls the broad contours of work, where it dictates the essential nature of the work, and provides guidance to the other party, which actually exercises the day-to-day directed immediate control, that forms a joint employer relationship. But that's actually a classic contractor relationship.
Well, they say, and the supplier firm, pursuant to the user's guidance,
yes,
makes specific personnel decisions and administers job performance on a day-to-day basis. So, the working words there are is pursuant to the user's guidance. I assume if, and I know it's not this case, so if Company X, we won't call it Browning Ferris, had all this going on, ordinary contract, but then the contract said, we reserve the right to have input on the operations, and then was, as it turned out, going, sitting up there in its window, supervising the floor, and said, that person's not efficient enough, and didn't say it to that person, said it to lead point, and said, that person is not efficient. They're slowing down the line. You got to move that person off. And then the next day said, that person, they're not concentrating enough. You got to move them off. And I think you've got too many, the next day said, on this, you got too many people on this line, not enough over there, you got to move them over there. All of this is to lead point, not to the employees, pursuant to this contract provision that says we get to have input. Would that be indirect control? And would that be relevant, something they could consider in deciding whether or not you're a joint employer, the Company X is a joint employer?
Yeah, it's not cognizable as control under the NLRA, given the prohibition against considering economic realities, which
Does economic realities mean I can't look at what Company X is actually doing on a day-to-day basis to control the people working in its workplace?
It's monitoring ends. It's monitoring worker performance.
The examples
in the sense
I gave to you they can't be considered.
Because
on Thursday they said fire that person. On Friday, they said, this cost-plus thing getting a bit pricey. Let's lower everybody's wages, all to lead point pursuant to our we get to have input. You're going to tell me that that is forbidden to be considered under the common law?
It is not control. It is guidance. It is monitoring.
That's your position. Okay.
That is our position.
All right. We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Joel Heller for the National Labor Relations Board. The Board's joint employer doctrine ensures that control over employees in the workplace carries with it responsibilities to them under the Act. In this case, the Board acted to place that doctrine on a stronger analytical footing, to clean up its precedent in the area, and to exercise its responsibility to ensure the continued vitality of the Act's protections. Specifically, it did two things. One, it reaffirmed that the standard for a joint employer relationship is whether two entities share or determine those matters governing the essential terms and conditions of employment. And second, it made clear what type of evidence it would consider in making that determination. Direct and indirect control and a reserved right to control over terms and conditions and the means and the manner of worker performance.
Can we pick up there? Can you tell me what indirect control means?
Sure. If you look at what the board was talking about when it says indirect control, the first example is, I think, what was just being discussed at the end of the previous exchange, and that is using Browning Ferris, using the lead point supervisors as intermediaries. And look at page 2 of the board's decision, JA370, where it says, control exercised indirectly, such as through an intermediary, may establish joint employer status. And there's evidence of that happening in this case, where Browning Ferris supervisors and lead point supervisors were in frequent communications, both in the pre-shift meetings and during while work was going on, where they would tell lead point supervisors things like, "We need to move these employees to that line because they're not our productivity standards, which Browning Ferris sets, is not being met."
If I'm a hotel owner and I have, say, 40 employees, I'm not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, right? Because it has to be 50. Is that the minimum?
Okay. I haven't looked at that in a while. But I assume
it is. But anyway, so I hire a lawn service people to come out, and they 10, 15 people. And one guy is cutting the grass too low, and I go to the supervisor and say, "Hey, listen, tell that guy to raise the mower up. It's too low." And another guy is putting mulch on top of my flowers around the bed. And I say, "Hey, tell that guy, you know, stop that. You're going to kill the flowers," and so on and so forth. And that happens day to day with the landscaping service. Does that mean that now, as the hotel owner, number one, because they have 15 employees, I'm covered by the National Labor Relations Act as a joint employer? And number two, that in fact, I have become a joint employer?
So the jurisdictional question, that is not something presented by this case, whether you can combine the two in order to create jurisdiction.
But it must be common throughout the United States where you have two employers, each of which has less than 50 people. But go on. Yeah.
Sure. So the using the other employer as an intermediary, I think if you have to look at what they are communicating, what are they using the intermediary for, if they're communicating directives to the employees about how to perform their jobs, that, like we have here, that is evidence of a joint employer relationship. It's not, you don't automatically become a joint employer. I mean, the board is still going to weigh the evidence. What the board did in this case was state that it's not going to per se exclude certain categories of evidence from the analysis at all. It's on the table, and the board is going to look at it, the indirect control like we had here. The other example of indirect control that we have in this case is where Browning Ferris, for example, sets out the shift times. They set when the lines will operate, when employees take breaks, and when the employees, a certain line will run into overtime. Lead Point then comes in and makes assigns specific employees to those various shifts. So we have both Browning Ferris and Lead Point contributing to work hours.
Why do you call that indirect? Isn't that direct?
Because Browning Ferris is not saying, Joe, you're going to work at 8 o'clock tomorrow. They're saying, here is when employees will work, and Lead Point is the one who says, Joe, you are going to work tomorrow. So you could call it co-determining hours. I think it is also a form of indirect control because there it is not Browning Ferris setting the specific guidelines itself. And that was a similar situation in the Third Circuit's Browning Ferris case, Browning Ferris of Pennsylvania. They had a similar situation where the one employer set the shifts and the other employer assigned particular individuals to work those shifts.
Of joint employers. If I have a restaurant, I have a lot of waiters, and I need every two nights or whatever, I need an exterminator to come in with his crew.
I'm not going to that restaurant.
And I say, I don't want you in there when we're open. Mm-hmm. The only time you can come in and perform that service on our premises is after we close. Is that evidence of joint employment?
The different situation there is that these employees in the bargaining unit are doing the core work of Browning Ferris. They are recyclers. It's not that they're bringing in someone to do niche work or some kind of specialized work.
Where did the board say the core work of the business is what we're limiting our decision to the core work? Did it say that?
The board didn't talk about that. I was because the facts of this case are.
But so that's not actually a limitation on their test.
It's not one of the multi-pronged factors.
So no, the board did not expressly say that is going to make a difference. It's again not presented by this case, so it's possible the board could say that's going to be a limitation, but it had no occasion to do so here. The other point. Counsel for the other side pointed out about when describing indirect, they said that this is all about influence, economic influence over the other, over Lead Point. But the board expressly said that it is not considering influence. It says on JA381, sufficient influence is not enough, however, if it does not amount to control. So it is making that distinction between influence, mere influence over the workplace, and control over the employees' terms and conditions and their work performance.
Well, when they say sufficient influence unless it amounts to control, do they mean unless it amounts to indirect control?
They didn't specify what kind of control they were talking about.
Does that matter? Because sufficient influence is, some might think, is just another word for indirect control, right?
Well, I don't think so. I think the board was trying to make a distinction there between influence and control.
But that's how it works. You know, the point is that the contractors want to make their customers happy. And so when someone comes in and says, I'm really unhappy with how slow this is going, particularly when I look at those five workers over there, boy, are they slow, they're dropping stuff, hitting the stop button all the time. I'm really unhappy about that. That's not what I expected under this contract. And, by the way, the contract says I have the right, I reserve the right to fire, to prevent anyone from working if I choose to exercise it. Is that influencers? And, of course, Lead Point goes, I don't want to lose this contract. They're out of here. They're out of this contract. They can go work on some other contract. Is that influence or is that indirect control?
So I think if it's a question of the customers or the contractors' satisfaction with the end result, with the product, and that is different, and that is not indicia of joint employer status.
Is what I said satisfaction with the end result, or is it with the work process?
So if the Browning Ferris actor in this situation, this hypothetical, and comes in at the end of the week or the end of the day and says, you know, I don't like what the output is now.
No, they say what I said, and let's say they say it at noon.
So are they on site? I think that the...
Okay, yes, they're on site.
I think that the point here is that Browning Ferris has this kind of continual day-to-day...
I guess I want to get back to... I don't want to go on to Company X. The hypo that I gave to you at noon by somebody on site, because that's how they can see those five people are working really slowly, and they're very unhappy about what they're observing. That's all I say. I'm extremely unhappy about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Lead Point knows they've got this reserved right under the contract. and Lee Point wants to make the customer happy, so they get rid of those five people. Is that influence or is that indirect control?
So they have the reserved right to, so that's reserved control. That's in the other bucket.
Yeah, that's generic over everybody. I'm trying to get you to understand the difference between influence, strongly articulated.
Right, I think influence.
Someone who wants to keep a customer happy and indirect control.
I think influence is a bigger picture. When there's, right, kind of bigger picture quality control, customer happiness.
Okay, so and, that wasn't what I was talking about in my hypothetical. So right, that was indirect control?
When I think it is more, when it is more granular, when they're getting involved in the details of the work performance, then yes, I think that counts, that is evidence of indirect control, as the board would have it. The, right, and we've already talked about the distinction the board makes between the end results, control over the end result, which it says is not indicia of joint employer status, and control over the means and manner of work, which the board says is or can be evidence of joint employer status. So the...
I just worry, I guess just to lay it on the line, my concern is, particularly with the indirect control, the board here didn't come out and sort of said, we're going to consider these two things along with everything else. But didn't sort of say what role they're going to have in that analysis, and didn't even apply the second prong of its test, which is, fine, you may have these joint employer indicia, but are they tied to your ability to participate, or are they relevant to collective bargaining, which I assume means are you a joint employer with respect to an essential term and condition of employment? Just didn't apply that second prong of its test. And by not doing so, by not saying, here's what we think they've got sufficient control over, looking at all these factors. Well, here's the thing, but just to get this, I just want to lay out for you my concerns so you can address it. Without having gone through that second step, without having said, we're going to consider these things, but how much weight do they carry, which the second prong of their test would have required them to do, that what assurance do we have that this test, and particularly indirect control, is going to continue to police the line properly between genuine joint employers and stepping into the realm where they can't go of really what's an independent contract? And they're just spending an awful lot of time on things that are limited and routine policing. What assurance without that further analysis do I have?
So I think the board did make that further analysis. If you look at the application section of the board's decision, it went through and it highlighted what evidence it found to be probative of the joint employer question. I think it breaks it down into three categories. Mm-hmm. And as to specifically, one specific example as to the whether there would be meaningful collective bargaining is when we're talking about, is when the board talks about the speed of the stream, of the streams as they go by, which had been a source of tension with the workers in the bargaining unit, and how Browning Ferris had sole control over productivity standards, what speed the line was going to go. And thus, bargaining only with Lee Point, if these employees could only bargain with Lee Point, that issue would not be addressed because
okay,
Browning...
Right, but so I get that they identified line speed.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about a few other things here and there where there is some evidence. But then they didn't go, how is this going to actually be relevant to the collective bargaining process? How is this going to work? Because you're now saying all we know from the board's decision is that they're a joint employer, certainly when it comes to line speed. We mentioned some other things. But then they don't go on to say, I don't understand how this joint employer status works. Once they're a joint employer, are they there to bargain on everything, or
no,
only the things that they control?
The board says. Do
they bargain on their own, or they have to bargain jointly with Lee Point?
So the board says that in this decision that a joint employer's bargaining obligation attaches only to those issues on which it has control. They don't have to come in and bargain about everything that goes on in the workplace. It's only those issues upon which that joint employer has control, and the board went through and...
Indirect, and it could be exclusively indirect and unexercised control. For example, someone, a union comes in and says, these wages are too low. They go to Lead Point. Lead Point goes to talk to us about it. They're the ones that have set the cap on it by the single Brown and Ferris employee. And you go to Brown and Ferris, and they go, look, all we've done is say, don't go past this person. That's all we've done. We've never exercised it. We're not doing anything else to do with wages. We got nothing to negotiate other than, you know, there's this cap here, which any routine contract can have as a cap on the price of the contract.
Well, I'm not sure they haven't exercised it because there is that employee who earns more.
Well, it's exercised because you've got a contract that says here's a cap on the price, but that's going to cover an awful lot of contracts and make someone, a lot of people join employers, isn't it?
So the kind of the practicalities of how this is going to work when they're two or more joint employer situation, that those kind of questions will come up under any joint employer standard whenever there is more than one party involved in bargaining.
Well, they won't come up if it's indirect, unexercised authority. But for this new test. It doesn't mean it's wrong. Whether it's right or wrong in the common law is something we have to address, but assuming that it's their legitimate common law factors, adding them back in when they haven't been considered in at least the key decisions that the board overruled, does push the line between employment, joint employment, and independent contracts in a way that wasn't before, and yet the board never grappled with that because it never got to the second prong of its test.
Well, there were cases prior to this 1984 or approximately 1984 shift where the board did consider indirect factors like indirect control and reserved control, and joint employer bargaining happened under those cases, and so there is kind of some history there. And
would the board test allow just evidence of just indirect and just unexercised, just indirect and unexercised control? Could that make someone a joint employer under this test? Do we know that or not?
Since that's not the facts of this case, the board didn't rule definitively one way or the other. I mean, I think that it doesn't rule out that possibility. That there
We can look at those factors, and those factors can actually be determinative, I assume.
That those, well, as you pointed out earlier, a factor is not much of a factor if it doesn't have
legal
weight.
So you could have that situation, but then we don't understand how the line between unexercised indirect control will be kept from stepping on real independent contracts. Like, I'm just not clear that the board grappled with that, partly because they just dropped the ball and didn't address the second half of their test.
Well, again, respectfully, I would dispute that they didn't.
We're really concerned about the speed. The speed here.
That was not the only factor that was addressed. I mean, maybe they didn't say we are now discussing our second prong about meaningful collective
bargaining. No, it's not just that. They didn't sort of say, I don't understand how essential terms and conditions work. You start splitting wages. You'll negotiate about part of the wage. You'll negotiate about the other. They just didn't. The second part of the test is this, we find these sort of joint employer factors. But is assigning this joint employer label here something that's going to be consonant with sort of the collective bargaining process? Is it going to be workable under the collective bargaining process? Is it going to police the lines that we know we have to police? And it seems like it just kind of left that out there. And even, I mean, Brown and Ferris says, we're not even sure, other than speed of the line, we're not even sure after reading the decision what things we are a joint employer asked to. The fact that, you know, once every 3 years we told someone to go stand somewhere else, is that they don't know what they're a joint employer. The union can come to them, they're not sure which things they're supposed to negotiate or not because the board didn't do the second half of its test.
Well, the board sets out examples starting at page 18 of its decision. It talks about hiring, firing, and discipline, supervision, direction of work, and hours, and wages. And so even though in the order itself it doesn't say the parties, Brown and Ferris, shall bargain upon request over this issue, this issue, this issue. There is information in the decision where the board talks about where it has found sufficient control by Brown and Ferris and which it has a role in bargaining. And, of course, Brown and Ferris knows what it does. It's not a mystery to Brown and Ferris the kind of arrangement it has with Lead Point. It is in control. It has that information.
I suspect they will say that it is certainly a mystery as to which things they did that turn them into a joint employer that has to negotiate, and which things were, in their mind, just ordinary, routine, setting contract terms. I can't imagine that there wouldn't actually be disputes going forward about what things they have to negotiate over and don't.
And again, those kind of disputes will arise under any kind of joint employer situation, and so it can't be a knock on this joint employer approach. Because
it can be when it used to be easy, right? They're directly doing this, and so it's easier to know what they're directly controlling. But when Lead Point's doing stuff, but Brown and Ferris has unexercised ability to indirectly, whatever that means, influence things, then do they negotiate too? And that's the part that wasn't brought home. The prior cases, I think that's why the board was quite candid and said, look, our prior cases have sort of dropped these factors, and that was wrong, and we're putting them back in. So we don't have cases that show where there's this confusion, where there's heavy reliance on indirect.
Right. So I think it is bringing up an important point, is that one of the things the board did here was clean up its case law, mm-hmm. and says we are faced with inconsistent strands of precedent. In that situation, the board did what this court tells it to do in such situations. It picks one.
Let me, before you sit down, would you agree with me that that the board is owed no deference from a court of appeals when the board's decision rests on an interpretation of a Supreme Court decision?
When the board is interpreting a Supreme Court decision, does it get deference?
Right.
No, I do not believe
it. Doesn't. And there are a lot of cases holding that. If the Supreme Court decision is a discussion of the common law of agency and employer-employee relationship, and the board rests on its interpretation of that decision, does the board get deference then?
So the deference as to a Supreme Court decision that was interpreting the common law?
Yes.
No, I think it's the same answer.
What if it's a court of appeals decision interpreting the common law? Does the Supreme Court or does the board get deference then?
So the board, we agree that the board does not get Chevron deference as to what the common law is. There is a degree of deference as to applying the common law, but as to this, the pure questions of what is the common law, the board does not get deference. I would point out in this case that we're not faced with a purely common law question in the joint employer determination.
No,
because
the board said that
it's
the
part of the analysis.
Of what a joint employer is dependent upon the common law. It said that in the opinion.
Certainly, the standard, the overall standard, is whether two employees share or co-determine matters governing terms and conditions of employment. Within that, part of that analysis is there a common law relationship? So as to that question, I agree with you. The board does not get deference. The ultimate question of whether two particular entities are joint employers, Brown and Ferris and Lead Point, is, as the Supreme Court said in Boyer, a question of fact. Mm-hmm. And that's reviewed for substantial evidence.
Okay.
Well, so let me make sure I understand what you just said. With respect to our review of whether this new test cleaning up the board's case law is reviewed de novo, your answer is what?
The test is not reviewed de novo. The test of whether there's a joint employer, that share or co-determined test, is reviewed for whether, it's a legal question, it's reviewed for whether it's rational and consistent with the Act, with the NLRA. The part of the test that as one element within that test that is a common law analysis, that the board doesn't get deference on that point of the analysis. And the other point I wanted to raise to you, Judge Millett, in response to your question before, is that these are fact-intensive cases. And so what particular types of indirect control will be probative in the future, and we will have those cases. And in this kind of, it lends itself to what the Supreme Court in Eastex called an evolutionary approach, rather than the imposition of bright line rules. And so there will be development, and there will be further guidance in cases going forward as to, excuse me, the types of evidence, indirect evidence, that would contribute to a joint employer finding.
Can the contract between Browning Forest and Ferris, excuse me, and Lead Point is terminable at will?
Yes.
If they're a joint employer, is it still terminable at will, or do they have to negotiate with the union before they could terminate the contract?
So whether the, how they could...
Can they terminate it at will, or do they have to negotiate with the union before they can terminate at will?
Well, if they, I think it depends on what kind of collective bargaining agreement they enter into. And whether
they have
that,
to bargain with the union over whether they can continue to terminate the contract at will?
If the collective bargaining agreement provides some kind of contrary instruction, then that would be
they don't raise it with the union.
Sorry?
Just say the collective bargaining agreement is silent on this question. Can they terminate it, or do they have to bargain with the union? Because, golly gee, it's sure going to affect the employees and the other things that are in the collective bargaining agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, the board certainly noted that it was terminable at will, but it did not place kind of heavy emphasis on that in the as a factor in the
My question is just as a matter of law. You know, there's legal rules on when companies that are, you know, don't dispute their status as a employer governed by the NLRA can just stop things without bargaining with the union, eliminate positions, things like that. So I guess I'm back to the same question. Can they terminate at will without negotiating with the union if they are a joint employer?
Well, so again, that's the kind of question that's going to come up in joint employer relationships, not particular to this approach to the joint employer relationship. So it's, I'll admit, it's not a question I fully thought about, but I don't think it matters so much one way or the other as to the propriety of this test, of this approach to the joint employer joint employer doctrine.
One question? Did you have, I know we had a lot of, or I had a lot of questions. Did you have one minute to wrap up?
Sure, thank you. So just a few remaining points, and that is the right to control, the reserved right to control, which we didn't talk about much here, is, I think, a pretty well-established common law principle. It shows up in the restatement. It shows up in this court's cases, both in the joint employer context, like the chemical workers case, and in the independent contractor cases, which are not really directly on point here because it's everyone agrees that these are not independent contractors. These people in the bargaining unit are employees. And looking at Hearst, I think it's just important to see what Hearst was doing so we know what the Supreme Court was rejecting. And Hearst specifically said, we're not going to apply the common law. We're not going to look to control as the touchstone of the analysis. The board is not doing that. So what Congress rejected in Taft-Hartley is something different than what the board is doing now. And then finally, just a few evidentiary points that I want to emphasize of why the board's finding is supported by substantial evidence that these two entities are.
Pick your best one, then, because we're past our minute now.
Okay. I apologize. And that is the kind of ongoing day-to-day monitoring of Lead Point employees by Browning Fair supervisors that is then transformed into action where they come into the line and instruct them, both one-on-one, standing at, you know, pick out that, and stopping all production, calling all the workers in for these big group meetings and telling them things, Browning Ferris supervisors telling them things like what technique to use when performing their work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Craig Becker. I represent the intervener, Local 350. I'd like to take up the invitation of my friend, Mr. Dittleberg, to talk about what's really going on in this case. And I think it's responsive to Judge Millett's question is, what exactly did the board rely on to find joint employment, and what does it tell us about what they'll hold in the future? Because as in all these cases, the board, in accordance with the Supreme Court instructions, looks at all the facts that suggest control. And I want to point to four of those facts, or highlight four of those facts that the board found here. One, the board found that BFI not only had the authority to, but actually did directly supervise these employers anytime it believed it was necessary to do so, and that it did so routinely. And I think it's important to quote what the board actually held in unchallenged findings. The board said, quote, BFI managers exercise near constant oversight of employees' work performance, not oversight of the product at the other end of those streams, but oversight of performance. The board then held, and again I quote, or found, excuse me, and again I quote, in numerous instances, BFI managers have communicated detailed work instructions to employees on the stream, held meetings with employees to address customer complaints and business objectives, and to disseminate preferred work practices and assign to employees tasks that take precedence over any work assigned to lead point. Now, this demonstrates not only actual control, but it also demonstrates what this court's decision in Joint Council of Teamsters, which is implicitly that BFI implicitly reserves the right to supervise the details of the work whenever it's necessary. What was going on here is that you had Lead Point and its employees operating in a unified chain of command. That is, this recycling facility operated no differently than had BFI conceitedly employed everyone. That is, they had a chain of command.
On the conveyor belts, were they doing all this by hand, or did they have some machine that sort of?
Your Honor, these workers, or at least the sorters, and there's three categories that were at issue, were doing it by hand. There were machines they called screens that screened out certain materials, but what these people were doing were actually standing at those streams and picking out what they were supposed to pick out. So in other words, the board found that BFI's managers continually exercised oversight of the employees, not the product, of the employees. And when they found it necessary to correct their work.
Did they say continually? Did the board say that?
The board said exactly that. It said, let me go back and give you the page. The board said that.
18 or 19?
Yes, they said page 19, exactly. I quote, BFI managers exercise near constant oversight of employees' work performance, not of the product, but over performance. Then, as I've said, the board...
That doesn't really support your proposition. Constant oversight means that they were out on the line looking. It doesn't mean that they were out on the line supervising.
Well, what does supervision mean with this type of unskilled work?
Well, that's a good question. If the BFI supervisor went up to the supervisor for Lead Point and said, I suggest that you tell that employee over there to stop dropping all this refuse on the ground, is that supervision?
There's two types of supervision that went on here. One, as I've said, the board found that routinely there is direct supervision. Numerous examples. Here's how you pick plastic out of the stream. Here's the best technique for it. When you take your break, you first have to clean up your workstation before you go on break. Those are direct, detailed commands from BFI managers to the Lead Point employees. Then there's indirect supervision.
Who determined when the break would occur?
The break was determined by BFI. When they stopped the line, that's when employees took their break. And they also went beyond that in terms of...
Is that a subject of negotiation between BFI and Lead Point?
It's not specified in the contract,
right? No.
That
just an understanding?
The understanding was the contract provided that Lead Point would supply personnel to operate under BFI's instructions. So the instructions were quite detailed in that regard, and that would be the third fact that I would point to, which is the board found that BFI exercised total control over the employee's workload. The board found, and again I quote, BFI dictates the number of Lead Point laborers to be assigned to each material stream. So they didn't say Lead Point, just come in and pick what we need picked out of these lines. They said, we want you to have five people here, six people there. And not only there, precisely there. So the board found, quote, the sorters occupy set workstations along each stream and that BFI dictates the location of those stations. So it wasn't just six on this line. It was here on this line, and here on this line. And then the board found, and again, I quote, BFI had sole authority to set the speed of the material stream. So in terms of the most basic term and condition of employment, how fast you have to work, controlled exclusively by BFI.
Who controlled vacation time?
Vacation time was not controlled by BFI.
But what about seniority?
We don't know if seniority was a consideration for
what
any...
What about maternity leave?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Maternity leave?
Vacation, all sorts of leave. There's no evidence that BFI controlled...
Was there a 401k plan that LifePoint had?
I am not certain, but there's certainly no evidence that BFI controlled it or required it.
Sick leave?
No evidence that BFI controlled that. So there's clearly, there's no argument that I would put before this court or that the board found that BFI controlled all the terms and conditions of employment. But that's not what the test is. The test, as you found, Judge Randolph, in the Dunkin' Donuts case, and as Judge Millett found in El-Safi, is control over some terms and conditions of employment. And so here you have direct supervision, you have routine indirect supervision, you have control over the most fundamental of working conditions, which is how fast do I have to work, and as my colleague has said, there was conflict about that issue. Employees were concerned that they were being required to work too fast. So if my client wants to bargain about that because it's unsafe or because it's impossible, they need to have BFI at the table.
Do we know from this decision that indirect just means I'm telling LifePoint and they're telling you, or is indirect cover more than that?
All we know
from this decision
is what the board held.
Mm-hmm.
And as in all common law adjudication, they use a term and then they apply it to the facts here. Mm-hmm. So we know two things. We know what the board said it does not mean. Mm-hmm. What the board explicitly said it does not mean is what BFI says the board says it did mean. And as the board says, it doesn't mean the ordinary requirements that any purchaser of goods and services applies in order to get what it's paying for.
Well, I thought they said we're, as Judge Wilkins said in sort of the double negative sentence, we're not going to any more decline to consider things just because they are part of the limited and routine oversight. So in fact, they are considering that, which I would assume would be part of indirect control. So they do consider it.
Yes, I think we know that the board has said we're going to consider as relevant reserve control, mm-hmm. indirect control, and what used to be discounted as limited and routine control, even if it's direct.
Mm-hmm.
But to know what those terms mean, as always in common law adjudication, we have to see how they were applied in this case. And they were applied in this case to what many of us would think would be direct control. That is, I see someone from up in the control room, a BFI manager sees an employee who's not picking plastic appropriately, and they send a directive, an explicit directive, down through the LifePoint supervisor on the line, correct this person's performance. Or they stop the line and allow people to take breaks during the stoppage of the line.
Well, how do I know what to do with line speed? Because on the one hand, if you're the person standing there, it feels very much like a condition of your work environment. On the other hand, if someone going to do a contract says, look, I get 1,500 tons of recycling in a day, and I've got to process 1,500 tons of recycling a day on these three lines. That's what my factory has. I can't afford to build more lines. I've got three lines. I've got 1,500 tons. I've got to come in, and they got to go out in a 24-hour period. I'd like a contract for workers that will get that done. Now, that level, it feels to me like that's just the contract term. It's the output. It's the product, even though the natural consequence of that is it's going to have to dictate the speed at which these folks are working. So is that routine contract product, things that the board shouldn't be considering, or is that a term and condition?
I think that's actually a perfect hypothetical to illustrate what the board held here and what it didn't hold here. Mm-hmm. So any entity in BFI's position would dictate what it wants to get through the contract, which would have some influence on terms and conditions. So if they had simply said, we're going to hire you to sort recycled materials, and we're going to dump this much at the door, and we're going to expect you to sort this many tons over this period of time according to these specifications at the other end, that would, of course, affect working conditions. But that's very different from saying, we're going to control where you place your employees, how many employees you place on the line, and we're going to control the speed of the line, when it operates and when it stops.
Well, speed of the line is just the way of, that's the speed it takes in the hypothetical. That's the speed it takes to process 1,500 tons a day. That's just calculable as a matter of math. That's the speed it has to go at. And as to number of employees, what if they instead just said, here's how much we're willing to spend. And by the way, you can't pay anyone a wage higher than you're paying our one employee. And so then it's for lead point to sort out how many people are there. Would that then still be something the board considers, or at that point is that just the ordinary contract terms?
That I think the board would say is an ordinary contract. That is, all specifications of product quality, the nature of the product, how quickly it has to be produced, and what we're going to pay you to do that, mm-hmm. obviously have some attenuated influence on working conditions and wages. But here there was much more than that. That is, they didn't hire Lead Point to produce a product according to a specified schedule or a set amount. They integrated Lead Point into their operation, maintained direct control over the employees, and direct control over the employees' work life. That is, it wasn't Lead Point who was deciding, the speed at which we have to produce this product, we want 15 people working instead of 4. Or we want six people on the line instead of 4, or we want them to stand in these places. It was BFI that made all those very detailed decisions about the work life of these people sorting on the line. That's very different from saying, here's how much we'll pay you, and here's what you're supposed to do in return, and here's the timetable.
Now, what exactly are the terms and conditions of employment that Browning Ferris is considered to be a joint employer based on this decision?
I would answer it in two ways, Your Honor. That is, everything, and the board hasn't specified it here because there hasn't been a refusal to bargain about a particular subject, rather, there's been a refusal to bargain about all subjects. But the evidence that the board relied on in finding control, I think BFI can be confident it will have to bargain about. So the speed of the line, clearly a term and condition of employment. Now, as Mr. Heller has pointed out,
What terms and conditions did the union ask to bargain about?
There was simply a general refusal to bargain. The way this statute somewhat peculiarly works is, in order to raise the issue which Browning Ferris wanted to bring to this court, they had to engage in what's called a technical refusal to bargain, i.e. a complete
refusal. But the union controlled that, right? The union must have said, hi, here we are. We'd like to negotiate with you over what?
Terms and conditions of employment.
That's all it said.
There was a general demand, as there usually is. Then it would be up to the parties to see if they could agree about what the terms and conditions were that BFI controlled, or if they couldn't agree, then a case might have to go to the board. That's consistent with a long history of joint employment. That is, the doctrine is not new, and the problem is not new. So if you have
What if I can't read this, after reading this board's decision, I can't figure out exactly what the terms and conditions are that they're considered a joint employer for? Is that a problem?
Would be unfortunate, but I think a reasonable employer could read the decision and find that. And the consequences of any confusion about that would be a refusal to bargain on a particular subject. If the union insisted on bargaining on that subject, there would be a refusal to bargain charge. The employer might be found to have refused to bargain, and the remedy would be simply bargain. So the consequences of being an employer are simply to bargain about what you control. They're not to reach agreement. They're simply to bargain. And the remedy for not doing so is, again, simply in order that you bargain.
Well, it's not always simply to bargain. They might have said, no, that's not something that we're a joint employer for, and we're putting this thing in place that we have. And then the order would come from the board, and they would have to retroactively unravel and unscramble something they'd had in place for 3 years. So it's not always just go talk. It actually can have some real hard impacts on the employer.
There is a possibility of unilateral change, but all of us who practice labor law know that that is a constant issue. Even in a bargaining relationship where there's only two parties, the parties often disagree about what the scope of the duty to bargain is. So it's not a new problem, and it's not a new problem in the joint employment context. It's an issue along the borders which always exists and can be adjudicated.
Do you have a position on whether the contract can be terminated at will once they're a joint employer?
I think there would be an argument, and our client might make the argument should they be found to be a joint employer, that they would have to bargain about what's essentially a decision not to terminate their employment, but necessarily, since they could be relocated to another location, but to either terminate their employment or relocate them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Diddleberg, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to address the question of what the common law and Taft-Hartley require, just to reiterate, with respect to active control, it should be the center of gravity of analysis. It has been the center of gravity of analysis under the common law and under this Court's cases, where it has looked most closely to what the actual practice of the relationship between the contracting parties is. With respect to this bucket of indirect control, there is no support for this concept in the common law. The board has cited to none. They've cited to one Fourth Circuit case, which was not even a joint employer case. And in unpacking this concept of indirect control, we have the notion of control that is based on requiring the customer to fundamentally change its business operations, you know, which Aurora Packing has found is not control. Some of the concepts that the panel has alluded to, line speed is amount. You know, we want to buy, you know, essentially this amount of labor which we need to efficiently run our business. That's what, you know, those kinds of factors are not what this court has found to be salient control factors.
Just to be clear, if under the contract, Company X would say to Lead Point 10 times a day, hey, Lead Point supervisor, go tell that person to stand somewhere else. Hey, Lead Point supervisor, tell them to start with their left rather than their right hand because we've found through studies that that's more efficient to do it that way. Hey, Lead Point supervisor, that person needs to be removed. They're not fast enough. Hey, Lead Point supervisor, they're not supposed to take their breaks till they clean up that area. If you have all that indirect, would you agree at least that type of indirect control can be factored in or not?
I think that goes to what the court in North American Van Line said, monitoring the ends of worker performance. You know, making sure that you get the benefit of efficient work to get the job done, you know, at the end of the day.
Not at the end of the day. This is throughout the day. Your position is that cannot be considered under the common law. As long as you launder it through someone you've hired, it's not relevant at all to whether they're a joint employer.
There's a difference between giving, you know, direct orders and pointing things out, which is, I think,
not
what
pointing
your example.
Out. I'm telling them because we know. The contract says that we get to have input, and 100% of the time when we do that, Lead Point executes it. That's the understanding.
We get to have input to our service provider who wants to make us happy, as an independent business exercising its discretion.
On the day-to-day movements and activities of individual workers day in and day out. To be clear, your position is no, that doesn't count.
No, I mean, I think close monitoring of ends along those lines.
That's not the end, that's the work. It's not the end, that's the work itself.
Well, if yeah, I mean, if it sees something, you know, a piece of, you know, garbage that, you know, should have been picked up that goes towards, you know, the end of efficient performance, I think they can point that out. And then Lead Point, as an independent business, has to decide how it's going to respond.
I would wonder whether OSHA would require that.
And in fact, you know, yes, I mean, there could be some statutory requirements. I mean, one of the other issues with the board's
OSHA, is Barn and Ferris the employer for OSHA purposes when all this trash and stuff is on the ground at its work site?
It is the premises owner, so it does have certain statutory responsibilities.
I can't remember, does OSHA use the word employer or not?
I don't know, Your Honor. But this is one of the problems with the test. You know, again, on that passage on 382 of the appendix, they say merely owning or controlling the premises. Well, you know, if that's the standard, everybody is going to be a joint employer. You know, everybody who
wants to. Doesn't the common law, I mean, it says where the work performed is one of its factors.
Well, in the comment to 220L, it distinguishes between following the rules of premises liability, you know, the kinds of rules that wouldn't distinguish between any visitor to the property, which is where the focus of Browning Ferris's safety rules go to, you know, versus very specific directives to an employee.
So I'm just to be clear, section 220 of the restatement, second E. I'm not talking about an example here.
Okay.
1E says whether the employer or the workman there, it's talking about for the independent contractor, supplies the instrumentalities, tools, and place of work for the person doing the work. So are you saying that the board can consider the place of the work where the work is done just as a factor or not under the common law?
If you look at the commentary, there is a distinction between sort of generally applicable premises liability and premises standards, you know, the mere fact that you're on the premises, and contrasting that with employment policies, you know, that do distinguish between employees and other visitors and basically anyone who has to be on the property. You know, there are OSHA and other standards that Lead Point as agents of a contractor, just as visitors to the property, would have to follow.
So that might just be a holder from the tort liability part of the test.
Well, I mean,
we care about where it happens for that in a way that we may not for this inquiry.
Right. So the testament's application has to be drained of economic influence. Again, the board says that it's not applying or considering economic influence, but it plainly is. The at-will contract is not controlling the employees. It's a sort of Damocles over the contractor. Requests, customer preferences, and the like are all not those probative types of control. And again, just lastly, the range of forms of control that this court has found to be consistent and other courts have found to be consistent with contractor relationships, customer preferences, monitoring and evaluating and statutory requirements, evaluating pre-performance qualifications and the like. I think a lot of the questions in this case can be answered by the court's existing control jurisprudence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.